eventually arrest them and then to put them on trial. And I think people like Rumsfeld and Cheney are pretty much aware of that situation, like Henry Kissinger in the past, and they are, for that reason, not coming to Europe anymore.
And very quickly, President Obama's approach to all of this, which was, let's look forward, let's not look back, in terms of whether or not these people will be held accountable. We have 15 seconds.
Unfortunately, very typical reaction. It's stupid, because if we don't care for the torture in the past, it will appear in the future again.
Hmm. Well, we're going to do part two of our discussion, and we're going to start by asking you about your client in Europe, Edward Snowden, who remains in political exile in Russia, the NSA whistleblower, and the importance of whistleblowers. Wolfgang Kallak is General Secretary of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, author of the new book, Law versus Power, Our Global Fight for Human Rights. And that does it for our broadcast. Happy birthday to Chirina Nadura. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Tina Geisler. I'm Amy Goodman.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 o'clock, coming up in just a couple of minutes. Sojourner Truth. Topics include the teacher strike in Los Angeles, migrant children, and Black Lives Matter. At 9 o'clock, Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, her weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's Flashpoints. Dennis Bernstein continues the special rebroadcast of the multi-part series, The Battle for Public Education in the 21st Century. At 11 o'clock, Between the Covers speaks with poet Nancy Huang. At 11:30, Words and Pictures, SW Conzer talks with Phil Proctor, the fire-sign theater humorist about his six decades as a writer and performer. All of this good programming because of members like you. KBOO.fm is the website to go to and click on Donate. It's 801.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st through Saturday, March 2nd. The Cascade Festival of African Films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include Razzia, a film from Morocco, and more at the Hollywood Theater, and Wale from Burkina Faso, Fig Tree from Ethiopia, shorts from emerging African filmmakers, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104, at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st through Saturday, March 2nd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. The six-day teachers' strike in Los Angeles, the second largest school district in the nation, has ended after teachers and staff members approved a new agreement between the teachers' union, UTLA, and the school district. Teachers are returning to the classrooms today. So what's in the contract? What, if anything, did teachers give up? How long will it take to implement the agreement? Our guest is Arlene Inouye, chair of the UTLA bargaining team. She has worked in the Los Angeles public schools for over 25 years. And the story of what is happening with migrant children separated from their families or being held in family detention centers has fallen out of focus in mainstream media. Last week, the Trump administration admitted that there are thousands more children separated than the 2,737 previously reported, and that they really don't know how many children were indeed separated. And it is unclear where all these children are. Our guest is Peter Shea, Executive Director of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. They provide legal defense for migrant children. Dr. Malina Abdullah, a founder of Black Lives Matter LA, has been charged by the city of Los Angeles with 8 criminal misdemeanor counts stemming from her activism relating to LAPD police killings of black and brown youth. Dr. Malina Abdullah is our guest today as part of our ongoing series, Campaigners for Black Lives. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Los Angeles teachers will be back in the classroom today after voting to ratify a deal between their union and school officials. That vote ends a 6-day strike in the nation's second largest district. Union officials said preliminary balloting showed the 30,000 members of United Teachers Los Angeles overwhelmingly approved the agreement. Ernesto Arce reports from Los Angeles.
The deal includes a 6% pay raise for teachers. It also includes provisions for providing a full-time nurse at all schools, along with a teacher librarian. The proposal also calls for the hiring of 17 counselors by October. Class size reductions, a key part of the union's demands, were included in the proposal, which outlines a phased-in reduction of class sizes over the next 3 school years. Alex Caputo-Pearl, United Teachers Los Angeles president, said the new deal was a victory that belonged to every educator who staffed picket lines and marched during the past week's rallies.
We went on strike in one of the largest strikes that the United States has seen in decades. And the creativity and innovation and passion and love and emotion of our members was out on the street, in the communities, in the parks.
UTLA teachers went on strike January 14th, calling for smaller class sizes and the hiring of more support staff, curbing charter schools, and a pay raise. In Los Angeles, I'm Ernesto Arce, Pacifica Radio, KPFK.
In Denver, Colorado, teachers voted overwhelmingly to go on strike after more than a year of negotiations. That strike could come as early as Monday. The main sticking point is increasing teachers' base pay, including lessening teachers' reliance on one-time bonuses for things such as having students with high test scores or working in a high-poverty school. Teachers also want to earn more for continuing their education. Senate leaders have agreed to hold votes tomorrow on rival proposals to reopen shut-down federal agencies. The vote will come on the eve of 800,000 federal workers missing a second consecutive paycheck. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell set up the two votes, one on the bill approved by House Democrats to reopen the federal government through February 8th, giving negotiators more time to talk. The second on McConnell's 1,300-page measure based on President Trump's weekend proposal. It ties reopening the government to 3 years of deportation protections for about 1 million immigrants and $5.7 billion for Trump's border wall. McConnell urged a yes vote.
The full investment in border security that the experts on the ground say they need, and changes to our immigration policies that are similar to the ones Democrats have themselves been fighting for in the past. To reject this proposal, Democrats would have to prioritize political combat with the president ahead of federal workers.
Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Trump's proposal was not made in good faith and amounts to hostage-taking.
The president's proposal is one-sided, harshly partisan, and was made in bad faith. The president single-handedly canceled DACA and TPS protections. He did it himself, on his own, a while back. Now, offering some temporary protections, back in exchange for the wall is not a compromise. It's more hostage taking.
Both Senate measures are likely to fall short of the 60 votes needed to advance legislation to a final vote. They will indicate, though, how many lawmakers of each party are willing to cross party lines. An Iowa state judge struck down the state's fetal heartbeat abortion law as unconstitutional. If upheld, it would be the most restrictive anti-abortion law in the nation. Judge Michael Huppert said prohibiting abortions at the detection of a fetal heartbeat violates both the due process and equal protection provisions of the Iowa Constitution. A fetal heartbeat can be detected as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy, when many women might not even be aware they're pregnant. The Oakland City Council voted unanimously on a resolution urging the Bay Area Rapid Transit District, BART, to name a street near the Fruitvale BART station Oscar Grant Way. The vote came 10 years after BART police officer Johannes Mesley fatally shot the 22-year-old African-American father as Grant lay face down on the platform of the BART station early New Year's Day. Grant's mother, Wanda Johnson, thanked the council and reflected on the past decade of activism to win justice for families of those killed by police.
Through Oscar's death, I want to say love in this community has grown even more by different communities coming together, seeing an injustice, and working to improve our judicial system.
I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. As you heard in our news headlines, the six-day Los Angeles teachers' strike ended on Tuesday, January 22nd, after teachers and staff members threw their support behind a new agreement reached hours earlier, according to the United Teachers of Los Angeles, UTLA. The vote by UTLA members enables teachers to return to work today, ending a battle that left 600,000 students in limbo, and the first week of the strike cost the school district more than $150 million, and that's not the final figure. So what we're going to do now, before we have our guests on, we're going to hear the voices of teachers talking about their concerns. And let's go to that clip now. And also we'll hear from Mayor Garcetti and the head of UTLA, Alex Caputo Pearl.
Smaller class size. We need smaller class sizes. We need more counselors.
More support staff. Yeah.
And nurses. Yeah. We just want better conditions for the kids, right, so they can strive.
So they can become successful. If we're successful, they can become successful. And we can teach our youth
what they need.
For African Americans, I just believe that this is a step forward for us. We've been fighting for so long, and I feel like for the students now to see this, the new generation, is going to uplift them to fight for even more, especially with the Trump the Trump situation going on too. It's going to push them to fight for more than just this, but it starts here. This is where they're learning, this is where they're growing, this is where the blueprint is made.
An activist from Black Lives Matter showed up to express the larger march that's going to be going on downtown as we speak.
I am truly thankful for you. I am thankful for your courage, for your commitment, and for your willingness to stand up. I thank you for that. You are an inspiration to us all. So give yourself a big round of applause.
At this point, along with the government shutdown, you can almost say that this is headed for some times like back in the 60s. So I'm Nash Baker. You're definitely watching LA Taco News. We're here at Dorsey High School, where there is a strike.
They continue to stuff more and more students in our classes, 39, 42, 53.
All we're asking for is for basic things that your child deserves: an educational right to a nurse and a librarian and a counselor.
As teachers, this is such an important moment for us. People don't see how much our kids lack. We see that every day. This is a moment where maybe the city is going to get a little glimpse of how how much this country has robbed our kids.
Year after year, dwindling money coming into the classroom, more and more kids in there. I feel like I'm not being as effective as I could be.
This district and this union that brought their passion, their persistence, and their commitment to talks here at City Hall, we spent the better part of these last 5 days and into a sixth day hashing out details. And I'm proud to announce that pending approval by the teachers of, represented by UTLA and education professionals and the Board of Education, that we have an agreement that will allow our teachers to go back to work on their campuses tomorrow.
So it's a historic day today in Los Angeles. We have preliminary numbers from the vote on our agreement, and they show that a vast supermajority are voting yes for the agreement that we made with LAUSD, therefore ending the strike and heading back to schools tomorrow. Our members, after a strike that began on Monday, January 14th, are going to be heading back to school to the students that they love and the classrooms that they love and the schools that they love and are committed to. They'll be heading back tomorrow, Wednesday.
All righty. So in that clip, you heard some teachers from Dorsey High School in Los Angeles, also from some other teachers in the district, and then from Mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, and finally the voice of UTLA, the Teachers Union President, Alex Caputo Pearl. I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Arlene Inouye, Chair of the UTLA Bargaining Team, a UTLA Secretary, and a Speech and Language Specialist. Arlene has worked within the LAUSD system for over 25 years and has three generations of LAUSD students in her family. Arlene, welcome back.
Yes, thank you, Margaret. I'm very excited to be back today.
Yeah, and very different from when we spoke last week. How do you feel about this agreement?
We feel it's a real win. It's not only, you know, this like one contract for the next 3 years, but it's about a shift. It's about a shift in investing in our schools. It's a shift in addressing the privatization, in specifically in relation to co-location, where the public, where the charter school can come onto the public campuses and use the space. It's a shift in really valuing the professionals who work with our children and seeing the diversity of our members, whether it's nurses, counselors, early educators, adult educators, just the needs of all of our students and all of our professionals. And so it lifts up public education in a way that I think has been very dramatic, and it's the most significant contract in our history, UTLA's history, which is about 50 years. But I think it also is a model for the national movement of educators, of what you fight for and can win when it comes to social justice issues, when it comes to prioritizing the students and the families and the needs of our schools, which have been starved for decades. We see the results when you come together and withhold your labor and put yourself on the line. You're joined by parents, you're joined by community, businesses, other labor unions, and we are a powerful force. And I felt like because of our collective action, we were able to get a lot of wins. I mean, it's not perfect because it never is, and some things are also going to be in stages and phases and in terms of additional staff, but it really sends a powerful message to the nation and world about what can happen with, you know, in negotiations. And I wanted to add too, Margaret, there were some permissive subjects of bargaining, which means that we weren't allowed to have them in our package when we originally submitted our proposals, but we were able to bring them back in at the end when we were able to conclude the agreement. And that included an immigrant defense fund. It included ending the Wandom searches, and in many of our piloting at 28 schools, a pilot program that will be phased in. And this is the school to prison pipeline that addresses black and brown students and discriminates against them, that our students have told us is very, very important to them. And so we are ecstatic to take a step in that direction. Green space on campus, getting rid of the bungalows, and community schools, investing more investments into community schools, which is our alternative to the charters. And that's where you have the parents, the educators, and the students at a local school being given money to develop what their priorities are, whether it's music, art, dual language, ethnic studies, whatever it is. It's a community school with the wraparound services with mental health and physical health needs addressed, and that we believe the whole child needs to be given the resources and the supports to be able to thrive and to, you know, give the quality education that this country is supposed to be about.
Well, I'm so glad, Arlene, you were able to join us today, because certainly what you have outlined about the Immigrant Defense Fund, the community schools, the green spaces, and the pilot program at 28 schools to end the random searches, I mean, those are not really being reported in the mainstream media. So I'm glad that you're able to share that information with us. Indeed, that is a big win. I know how important these things are, having been a mom of my daughter went through the public school system in Los Angeles, and also as a former teacher myself, how important these things are. But Arlene, before we talk a bit about the charter school issue, the Los Angeles teacher strike was there were seven major teacher strikes or walkouts before Los Angeles. Los Angeles became the eighth, right? And, you know, what people refer to as the Red for Ed movement. And it started in a red state like West Virginia, but Los Angeles was different in that this one, the union was involved in the leadership of it. The other strikes in the red states, that was not necessarily the case. And in some instances, I think in, I can't remember which states, but in some instances, the teachers were really up against the unions, you know, or the associations, if they didn't have a union that represented them, to really push them to stand firm. So what can you say then about the significance of this, given all the attacks coming down against labor unions nationally, and the example then that this union-led strike sets?
Yes, Margaret, I do feel that we are a good model and example of how a union can really fight for the people. And, you know, this contract campaign is, we were in, you know, negotiations for 21 months, but it really goes back to 4 years ago when we put together a leadership team called Union Power with this agenda, you know, that we would really elevate student needs, we would be about social justice, we would be a fighting union against the privatization and the billionaires in LA. So we had a very, very clear vision, and it was for the schools our LA students deserve, which, you know, we overwhelmingly were put into office and supported, and our members even willingly increased their own dues by 30% in 2009, and really gave us their trust, and I think showed us that, yeah, people believe in this stuff. And so we were able to push forward this approach to the union. As an organizing union, we built systems and structures so that we have a chapter chair at every school. We have a team of leaders. We were able to get chapter chairs in all of our itinerant groups, you know, for the early ed, for the adult ed, but also the speech and language, the nurses, the counselors, the PSA counselors, the PSW counselors. Each group, we were able to develop leadership. And so you have these systems, and including the research, the political, the organizing department, and parent community department. We didn't have a parent community organizer four years ago, but we've been able to bring in a couple of leaders there. So you you really model your union to be a democratic union that really addresses all the needs of our members and really highlights and puts forward an agenda for the schools our students deserve. And I feel that, you know, Chicago in 2012, I feel like started this revolution in really focusing on the closing of black and brown schools and taking a stand.
Yeah.
And we've been seeing this grow. You know, there is a whole movement nationally. And this has just really been highlighted. Last year, we were so excited, you know, about our brothers and sisters in the red states. And, you know, California, we are, you know, we're a very blue state, as you said. And we, you know, we've been, you know, at the bottom in spending, so we haven't had an investment. But in addition to that, you have, you know, the neoliberal corporate Democrats who've been pouring money to privatize our schools. People like Eli Broad, who said he wanted to take out half our schools and make them charter schools. And so we've had to fight back against that agenda that's been fueled by the California Charter School Association, putting in political candidates on our school board that support privatization, that hired Austin Buettner, who's a Wall Street banker, who was our superintendent with no educational experience. So this is what the bigger fight is about, and it's ground zero in L.A. So I know everyone was telling us, if you win in L.A., we know that we'll win across the nation.
Right,
so
and then
we're so honored.
Yeah, and the New York Times is reporting, Arlene, that Denver has already begun voting on whether to strike there. And in Virginia, teachers planning a statewide protest later this month. And teachers in Oakland, California, have been watching L.A. very closely. Now, two things. Tell us about the charter school, because in the negotiations, because there was the elected school board for the district. They're supposed to vote on a resolution asking the state to establish a charter school cap. Now, again, the New York Times is reporting there are 100 new charter schools to open each year in California. It seems like quite a lot. So how do you think that's going to go? I wanted you to address that issue. And then there's the issue of paying for all of this. And there's been some talk about a change in the statewide property tax laws that will help to cover the costs. Arlene Inouye.
Yes. So first of all, Margaret, in relation to the charter cap, we have a charter school law in the state of California that was from 1992, and it's one of the worst in the nation. And it allows, charter schools to have, just to be able to open up anywhere, unregulated and unaccountable. And so they've been able to come into, you know, public schools, and there has been no cap, no limit, and no accountability. So that's been a big problem. We have, you know, in LA, we have the largest number of charter schools, around 277. And so
20% of all students in LA, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. 1 out of 5 students go to a charter school. So what this did is, because, you know, the state, it has to be addressed at the state level. We were able to put in that the school board would have a resolution calling on a charter school cap. So we're very hopeful about that passing, even though, you know, again, you know, there's been charter school money to influence our school board. It will be voted on. And again, this will signal a change, a shift in the direction, and start moving to address the charter school issue in the state of California. And at the same time, we have been working for several years now with a broad coalition to get a measure on the ballot called Schools and Communities First. And that would put about $5 billion into public schools every single year when that passes.
Wow.
It's to address the inequities of Prop 13, where there were loopholes for corporations to not pay their fair share of property taxes. So it only addresses the corporations. And this is really important, too, because we're seeing a shift in people understanding that, you know, we've been starving our schools and that we need to change directions and how we look at state funding. We're also getting county funding now for the nurses that we put into our agreement,
yeah,
as well as
right.
mental health. So looking at, you know, the bigger picture in terms of who can, how can we get money in from different places to support a quality public educational system?
Right. So then it seems as though all of the broad support that you got from the community and across Los Angeles, that efforts now seem to have to go into supporting the schools and communities first proposition, would you say?
Absolutely. And we're also having a school board election very soon. In March, so that makes a big difference too in the direction of our union.
Yeah, and our very own Jackie Goldberg is running for a seat on the school board. She formerly was on the school board and head of the school board, and
right.
So we'll see how all of that goes. Just finally, was there anything you felt you did not get that you really wanted and didn't get in this agreement?
You know, that's a great question. I think I've just been focused on how we got more than I really expected.
Okay, yeah.
It's been 21 months, and we've been, like, hit with a stone wall most of the time where the district would not budge on these issues that we, you know, that we put forward. But it's because of the collective action and the mass support that shut down our schools and, you know, the district. We had great leverage with the district, and they wanted the strike to end, and so they were able to agree to things that I had never expected we would be able to win. So I know it's not everything, you know, for every single member, but it's a pathway.
It's a fantastic victory, actually. I in my view, from everything you're describing and what
yeah.
I'm reading, and also given the shyness, I'll have to say, of labor unions across the country to take action, right? Over, you know, for quite a long time now, I think that the teachers are really showing the way right now. So we'll see the impact, the broader impact that this would have on other labor unions across the country that we know are definitely under attack. So Arlene, I know how hard you have worked. Congratulations to you, the entire negotiating team, to the union, but especially to all of the teachers who hit the streets and who were so enthusiastic and really made all of this happen. Thank you. Thank you for your service,
you,
is what I like to say. Yes. Thank you, Arlene.
Thank you, Margaret. It's just my joy and honor to be a union leader,
yeah.
to be an educator, to be a speech therapist. It, you know, it's great.
It's absolutely our most precious resource, our children. And we really cannot, we can never forget that. Thank you, Arlene Inoue, and congratulations again. All righty. We are going to take a station break. Coming up, Dr. Malina Abdullah joins us. She is being charged with something like 8 criminal misdemeanor counts, all for protesting LAPD shootings, and also what is happening with migrant children. The Trump administration admitted that there are a lot more children that were taken than initially were reported, and it's unclear where these children are. Peter Shea is waiting to join us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Good morning. It's 8:33. This is KBOO Portland.
All righty, higher ground. Stevie Wonder. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And our Instagram and Twitter handle is @SoTrueRadio. We're also on SoundCloud. It's a free download to get SoundCloud. And just look for us there, Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And in our tradition, we like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in other parts of the nation and the world. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Bellingham, Washington. And internationally, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in New Zealand. We're going to turn our attention now to our Campaigners for Black Lives ongoing series. The Los Angeles City Attorney's Office has charged Dr. Melina Abdullah with 8 criminal misdemeanor counts stemming from her activism related to LAPD shootings. If convicted, Dr. Abdullah could spend a year or more in jail. And there were pretrial hearings that happened Tuesday, January 22nd. And here to discuss all of this, we want to welcome back to Sojourner Truth, Dr. Melina Abdullah. Melina, welcome.
Hi, Margaret. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Dr. Melina Abdullah, professor, author, community organizer in Los Angeles, professor and chair of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA, and immediate past campus president and current counsel for Affirmative Action Chair for the California Faculty Association, which is a faculty union. She earned her PhD from the University of Southern California in political science and her bachelor's from Howard University in African American Studies. She was appointed to the Los Angeles County Human Relations Commission in 2014 and is a recognized expert on race relations. She is the author of numerous articles and book chapters with subjects ranging from political coalition building to womanist mothering. Okay, quite a lot there. So, Melina, first of all, tell us about, in a way, it seems ludicrous, right, that you're charged with 8 criminal misdemeanor counts. Tell us about that. How did all that happen?
Well, on May 8th, so we're often, we have a regular presence at Los Angeles Police Commission. Every Tuesday morning, we monitor the group that's supposed to be monitoring the police, who really acts as a rubber stamp body. It's headed by multimillionaire Steve Soboroff, and they don't like us to be there. And so, on one of these weeks, there was an incident. I'd arrived a little late, where the aunt of Waukesha Wilson, Sheila Hines Brim, allegedly threw the cremated ashes of her niece into the face of the ousted police chief, Charlie Beck. Now, I was just entering the room when this happened, and the allegation was that in the commotion that followed, I touched the arm of a police officer in a way that they so they're not alleging I punched him or pushed him or anything like that, but the truth is I didn't even touch him. And there was a white ally that was with us who said, you know, she was the one who touched his arm, right? So we didn't think much about it because I've been arrested out of there several times. There's many, many unwarranted arrests out of that space. They try to criminalize and intimidate those of us who go to that space. And so I didn't think much about it. I mean, it was a longer arrest than normal. The interrogation was more intense than normal. But ultimately, I was released on OR. And it wasn't until a few months later that I got a letter in the mail saying I was actually being charged with battery on an officer. And
wow.
So I was astounded, and I wound up getting wonderful pro bono legal help, and we went to court for the arraignment, and we were surprised to see that in addition to that one count, we had the city attorney's office, Mike Feuer, who tries to act as if he's a liberal, had tacked on 7 additional counts.
Wow.
Including a date. So there were 7 counts, not just from that incident, but they'd gone through all this video of the police commission meetings and included 2 additional dates, one of which I wasn't even arrested on that date, but they waited 364 days to file charges for what they call a disruption during a meeting.
You know, this isn't about any criminal activity, as you and I know, Melina, but it really is, and to me, shows how effective you in particular and Black Lives Matter in L.A., you know, have been in really calling out LAPD and also the Jackie Lacey, the city's attorney, for really not charging police officers in so many deaths. So to me, this is really just about trying to shut you up and shut you down. I don't think that's going to work. In fact, positive, that's not going to work. But meanwhile, though, you do need support. I mean, how long are the pretrial hearings going to be going on? Do you have any sense of that? How long all of this will take? I mean, you're just being targeted, period, by the city.
Right. And I want to be clear that they're targeting me now, but they've targeted two other Black activists in the past. And again, these are all charges from City Attorney Mike Feuer. So they charged General Jeff. They alleged that his crime was walking out the wrong door. And then they charged Akili, who we call Baba Akili, and charged him again with a battery on a police officer count. He beat that, but then they like to tack on a resisting arrest charge. And so he was what they did, and you're absolutely right, what they're trying to do is silence us. They banned him from police commission meetings for a year. Now his ban lifted a couple days ago, and so he was with us yesterday. Yesterday was a pretrial hearing for me, and over 200 people came to my court date.
Wow.
I have, again, a tremendous legal team. National Lawyers Guild, ACLU, is involved, and it's headed by Carl Douglas, who many people will know, worked with Johnny Cochran on the O.J. Simpson case, and they're all volunteering on this case. And so 200 folks showed up knowing that it's the criminalization of Black protest. It's not just targeting me, but it's targeting Black protest generally. And so we want people, if you believe in our right to protest, which is protected by the First Amendment, then we need you to show up. And so my next court date is February 7th at the Criminal Courts Building, 210 West Temple, Department 43. We think that, so yesterday my case was continued, or the pretrial hearing was continued, to February 7th. We think what they're doing with these continuances is hoping that support will die down. But really what we're seeing is even more support. So please come out February 7th at 9:00 in the morning at 210 West Temple. And then we need constant pressure on the city attorney. Mike Feuer has made it known he plans to run for mayor. Is this the kind of leadership we want in the city when he is going after, you know, people who are protesting? Let's be clear, what we're protesting is the killings of our people at the hands of police. We should be protesting that. What he's not filing charges on are these police who are engaging in misconduct. We know he can't file the murder charges, but all the misdemeanor counts he has control over, and he's not doing that. Instead, he's criminalizing protest. So we want folks to call him and tell him this is not the kind of leadership that we want, and people can call his office at 213-978-8100, 213-978-8100, and just make your voice known. You know, make it known that we have a right to protest. And then there's petitions going around, a Color of Change petition. If you're an academic, Scholars for Black Lives, it's done an open letter. So we want everybody to make their voice heard so that he knows, and, you know, those who try to criminalize us know that it's not just about one person, that the community stands together. And I'm very, very grateful to all of the people who've stood up, all of the organizations. My union, you were talking about unions earlier. My union has been tremendous. The California Faculty Association has been a tremendous force. Black Lives Matter, White People for Black Lives. Everybody's been there. My elder, who's like my Baba, who you know, Hank Jones was with me, who was a political prisoner. Black Panther, who was a political prisoner, was there. And so please come out and support and also make your voice heard, that we have a right to make our voices heard, right?
Yep. Yeah. Well, Malina Abdullah, we're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to be following this. You work with us each week on our Campaigners for Black Lives. And yesterday we made sure that all of our listeners knew about the pretrial hearing, the time and location, et cetera. We will also continue to post this information on our social media. So we appreciate you and all the best to your children there. Hopefully they're not too worried about all of this. And congratulations on your daughter, Tandwe, being named, what is it, one of the 25 most influential teenagers in the world?
Yes,
that's wonderful.
She was with me in court yesterday.
Yeah, and I love,
thank you, Margaret.
I love that her handle is Little Sojourner. We look forward to doing more with her. Thank you, Dr. Malina Abdullah.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Now, across the U.S., undocumented migrants, their children, and defenders of migrant human rights are facing renewed attacks, negligible treatment by the administration of Donald Trump. According to a new Inspector General report released on Thursday, January 17th, the Trump administration doesn't know how many children were separated from a parent or guardian last year in 2018. But it's thousands more than the 2,737 that the administration previously acknowledged. Okay, so the excuse that they're providing by the Department of Health and Human Services was that there were significant challenges in identifying separated children. Give me a break, okay? This comes as refugees from Central America continue to make their way across Mexico to the U.S. border with the hopes of applying for and seeking asylum in the United States. Last week, a new migrant caravan departed from Honduras, with hundreds more from Guatemala and El Salvador joining in. The new migrant caravan is currently in Mexico and is receiving assistance from the new government of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. At least 22 migrants have died in custody of U.S. Immigration Enforcement since Donald Trump took office, including some who had been longtime legal residents of the United States from all over the country. This, according to USA Today. The 22 deaths include at least one transgender woman, Roxana Hernandez, who died within 2 weeks of being taken into U.S. custody, and two young children, ages 7 and 8, from Guatemala. Meanwhile, we hear Trump has basically shut down the government because he wants his wall. Before we bring our guest on, let us go to a clip from Associated Press.
Maria Orbelina Cortez says she fled El Salvador after years of violent spousal abuse.
I will always feel guilty, always.
She blames herself for not leaving sooner, her regret visible in the form of a scar on her 3-year-old son's head.
One morning when I was making breakfast for the children, he hit me and with one blow knocked me against the stove and a saucepan on there exploded. The saucepan was on fire and it fell on my child. My older child grabbed the pan so it would not continue to drop more oil on him.
After months of planning in secret, Orbelina took her son Julio and his two older brothers north without telling her husband.
My goal is to work and see my children grow, watch them forget everything that was done to them.
All four are now in South Texas in the care of a Catholic charity shelter. Thousands of parents and children cross the U.S.-Mexico border monthly with harrowing stories like Orbelina's, an increasing wave of migration straining government resources, ill-equipped to handle a crush of families. The president's push for $5.7 billion to expand a border wall, also triggering the longest government shutdown in history, is unlikely to stop them from coming.
Many of the families that we see here for sure have entered either to a point of entry or through between points of entries and through the river. You know, either way they try to cross because they know there's no other way to do it.
President Trump visited the Rio Grande Valley 2 weeks ago to promote the wall, only a few miles from where Orbelina and her children now stay. His administration is already preparing to build 33 miles of wall next month. Most of that construction will follow flood control levees, leaving a significant chunk of land exposed to the Rio Grande River, the river dividing the U.S. and Mexico. That means people still can cross the river, make it to American soil, and request asylum. Some wait at ports of entry like Orbelina did, 2 days in her case, but others wait longer, weeks or months. The Department of Homeland Security wants policy changes so it can hold families in detention longer and also deport unaccompanied minors more quickly. Officials have requested $800 million in humanitarian aid. The Trump administration claims many asylum seekers make illegitimate cases. Immigration courts denied about 65% of asylum cases last year.
Yes, it is important that we secure our borders, that we keep our country safe from criminals, but he needs to meet the families that are not criminals. He needs to meet the children and the great number of families that are here asking for protection.
As for Orbelina, she hopes to divorce her husband and move her family to Los Angeles to be with her parents.
I know they have moments when they suffer because they do not have the love of a father.
But her dreams of safety may only be fleeting should the federal government deny her asylum claims. John Moen, Associated Press, McAllen, Texas.
Okay, so we'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth Peter Shea, Executive Director of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. The focus of his work includes technical support on constitutional rights of immigrants, refugees, and children, class action litigation on issues with broad impact on indigent, minority, and ethnic communities. He's been active in providing legal defense for migrant children who are currently being detained at the border. Peter Shea, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Peter Shea, it's shocking that the administration is now saying, well, there are thousands more, and we really don't know how many. What do you know about the numbers of children who have been separated from their families or even the numbers detained in family detention centers, Peter Shea?
Well, we know that under the Trump administration, the number of unaccompanied minors being detained has skyrocketed over the past 12 to 16 months. Under the Obama administration, there were maybe 2,000 or 3,000 unaccompanied minors detained at any one time. And the reason that that number remained fairly stable was because the Obama administration at least made some effort to comply with the Flores settlement, which is a nationwide settlement that remains in full force and effect, that we entered into with the federal government in 1997. And that settlement basically has two components. One, that children in detention will be treated humanely. And secondly, that children in detention have the right to reasonably prompt release from custody unless they are a flight risk or a danger to themselves or others. However, President Trump has issued orders to really slow down the release of these children. He's advocated time and time again for the termination of the Flores settlement. He put that most recently in a letter to the Congress on January the 4th, in which he both demanded approximately $5.7 billion for the wall, but added that he wanted legislation to terminate the Flores settlement so that children could be detained until the termination of their removal proceedings, something that could easily take months, if not years. Because of that policy of detaining children indefinitely has seeped down to the frontline officers, the number of children being detained has skyrocketed, and it now, the most recent data that we have received from the government states that there are now about 15,000 unaccompanied children in custody. So that is the struggle that we're currently facing to deal with this slowdown in release of children, both in the courts but also now in the Congress.
So what happens then when a child is detained? Let's say one of these 15,000 who are in custody. What's the process?
Well, the process is fairly straightforward. Thousands of these children, probably approximately 3,000 of the 15,000, are now being detained in military-style camps, one in Homestead, Florida, and one in Tornillo, Texas, that the federal government has had to set up simply because the facilities they had traditionally contracted with, there's no more bed space. And so they have opened up two military-style operations. They're completely unlicensed, which is a clear violation of the Flores Settlement. The Flores Settlement says that children are to be properly released, but to the extent that they are temporarily detained, they are, again, unless they are flight risk or danger, they are to be detained in licensed, non-secure facilities. Those are facilities that are licensed by the state in which they are located for the housing of dependent children. These military-style camps that they have set up are completely illegal. They're unlicensed. They are secure. And indeed, the other facilities they operate, close to 100 facilities to detain these children, while many of those are licensed, they are all secure, which also violates the settlement. The way that they have accomplished, one way in which they have accomplished detaining a larger and larger number of children is by seriously discouraging their parents or their relatives to come forward to seek their release. It has to be understood that about 40% of apprehended minors have parents living in the United States. About another 40% have relatives, close relatives, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, grandparents, living in the United States. Of course, the majority of those parents and relatives, or a large number, are undocumented. One of the policies the Trump administration has initiated is to formally, not just officers, rogue officers on the front lines acting this way, but as a formal policy, is to inform those undocumented parents and those undocumented relatives that if they come forward to collect their children, they will be fingerprinted, and their fingerprints and their names and their addresses will be turned over to ICE for purposes of arrest and deportation. So they're in essence holding these children now as bait to try to capture their parents and their relatives. So that is certainly one of the main factors that has resulted in a skyrocketing population of children being detained. And now, of course, President Trump attempted, he ordered former Attorney General Sessions in June of 2018, when he ordered the end of his own separation policy of separating children from parents. And under public pressure, he signed an executive order ending that separation policy. He blamed the Flores Settlement, said the Flores Settlement was forcing the separation of children from their parents, which was completely untrue. The Flores Settlement has benefited hundreds of thousands of children over the past 20 years. Not a single one was ever separated because of that. When he ordered the separation policy to terminate, he ordered Attorney General Sessions to immediately go into federal court and attempt to terminate the Flores Settlement. That failed. Now, on January the 4th, he wrote a letter to Congress in which he demands his $5 billion for the border wall in order to end the shutdown, but he added another requirement to his list of demands, and that was that Congress legislatively terminate the Flores Settlement. And then most recently, the White House had introduced into the Congress its bill to terminate the shutdown. And you have to, it's a long bill. It's over 1,000 pages long. And you'd wonder, why do you need such a long bill just to end a shutdown? You go all the way to around page 1,200. There they have several pages of legislative proposals that would not only terminate the Flores Settlement, but would prohibit children, minors, from seeking political asylum in the United States, unless they had applied for political asylum in their home country.
Oh, please.
So that's what we're now facing.
Well, Peter Shea, we're going to have you back. And indeed, I'd like to do something way more in-depth about all of this with you. But for people who want to get more information and to support your efforts, what should they do?
We would urge people who would like to support these efforts to help protect these children. Most of these children are completely innocent. They're fleeing for their lives. They're fleeing extreme forms of violence. We would recommend that people go to one of the websites we have, which is www.reunify.org.
Okay.
www.reunify.org. And there they can volunteer in a multitude of different ways to help us assist these children, including detention site visits.
Okay.
Children,
we're going to have to leave it there, Peter Shea. We are out of time, but we will post that website on social media and we'll have you back very soon. Thank you for joining us. Okay. We are out of time. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our board op, Teddy Robinson, our assistant producer, Ramiro Funes, today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up, it's Press Watch. Then at 10, Flashpoints. Dennis Bernstein continues the special rebroadcast of the multi-part series, The Battle for Public Education in the 21st Century. At 11, Between the Covers speaks with poet Nancy Huang. At 11:30, Words and Pictures with S.W. Konser, talking with Phil Proctor, the fire sign theater humorist, about his six decades as a writer and performer. Teresa Mitchell is ready next on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the NAACP kickoff to Black History Month on Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library in Vancouver, Washington. The NAACP kickoff to Black History Month features performances from African drummers, actors and storytellers, artist talks, a presentation by the Buffalo Soldiers of Fort Vancouver, and much more. Again, that's the NAACP kickoff.